Hey, this is Ed Jurdy from the Band of Heathens, and you're listening to Rock and Roll Archaeology.
Is there a library, a bookstore around here where I get books on
rock and roll?
Rock and roll.
Story's true.
Well, have you read this one?
Yes. Read my book?
This is a story that needs to be told.
These rock and rollers want something to read.
Shh. Quiet, please.
Welcome to another edition of Rock and Roll Librarian. I had to think about that for a second.
Yeah, you really.
I was almost going to say Deeper Digs in Rock.
Where am I?
Because I've been doing a lot of Deeper Digs in Rock stuff lately. But no. This is a companion show to Deeper Digs in Rock, and even Deeper Dig in Rock by a professional, ex-professional librarian. Although you're still, you're still official. I think you're still even working over there, right?
Yeah, I'm playing with my titles. I'm either a librarian emeritus.
Oh.
Or a return retiree, which is really my official title.
But return retiree.
Yeah, I'm working between 10 and 12 hours on fascinating things like contracts. So
let's change the name of the show to Return Retiree Rock and Roll Librarian.
Now, how about Rock and Roll Librarian Emeritus?
That sounds like a
professor. I like
that. Okay. Yeah, okay. Rock and Roll Librarian Emeritus.
Yeah.
Cool. Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing okay. I've been in my more free
in your cups?
Time.
You've
in
been
my
in your cups?
No, not
or
no,
your
I'm
feels. Or you been in your feels?
PG tips.
Your PG
I'm in my
tips.
PG tips.
Yeah, me too. It's that time of day, folks.
It's a little too early for beer. Yeah, and whiskey. So yeah, but I've been spending my time in semi-retirement by playing more music.
That's
and
right.
being in an extra band and really growing that way. So that's really fun.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Very cool. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're chasing your passion.
I know. It's, you can chase your passion at any age, people.
Yeah.
That's what I want to say.
You know, retirement pays you to do so.
Yeah. Well, it pays me to do so. Not everybody. I'm very fortunate in that way.
Yeah. Yeah. You chose correctly, at
civil service.
Age. Yeah.
Kids.
And now it's paying off.
Yeah.
Right. Right. Yeah. Good for you. Fuck you, Cheryl.
And you?
That's not true. I'm very happy for you. And besides, we're doing the entire Pantheon podcast here for me. So I am very busy, but happily busy.
Right. You found your passion.
Yeah. Lots of great stuff going on. So,
yeah.
All right. So what do you got teed up for us this episode?
Teed up. Interesting. You should say T, word, the letter T.
Oh.
First, I thought we could just listen to a bit and see if people know who we're going to be talking about today.
Ooh, secrets.
A bit
secrets.
Of a song.
Oh, okay. It's a guessing game.
Yeah.
Oh, all right. All right. So let's play a little bit of a fairly, sort of famous song. I mean, I know it. You know
mm-hmm.
it. But let's see what everybody else thinks, and then we'll give the big reveal on the other side. Well, why don't you tell everybody what the name of that tune was and why we started the show with it?
Yes, and T's are very much involved. The name of the song is Time is Tight, and the name of the book is Time is Tight, My Life Note by Note, and the author is Booker T. Jones.
Booker T. Jones and the MGs.
Yes,
Booker T. and the MGs.
Yeah. That's right, that yeah. Booker T. Yeah. It's his memoir.
So we're talking stacks today.
We're talking stacks. We're talking Duck Dunn, Steve Cropper, Al Jackson Jr., the rest
monsters.
Of the MGs. We're talking Jim Stewart, who was the studio owner.
Yep. Yep.
And all kinds
of the stacks.
Yes. And huge numbers of people that this man, Booker T. Jones, has worked with throughout the years and is still working with. He's a musical genius, and he has written a very readable and interesting memoir, which is basically a series of essays. And following along with the idea of the title, Time is Tight, the essays are not necessarily in chronological order. So he's saying time is tight and time is loose too. And all of these things that happened to me in my life, they come to the forefront and to the background, and they're related to each other in some way. So I didn't feel like I could really follow a strictly chronological order.
Sounds like something a genius would do.
Yep. And adding to the genius of it is before every chapter, he has a little musical phrase that he refers to that corresponds to the feeling of what he's talking about in the chapter. And he's written new musical phrases that when you listen to the audiobook, which I did, you can hear the musical phrases and hear kind of how maybe there's like 12 of them, and they, you know, they're interspersed throughout the book, and how that kind of ties in the themes of the book in a musical way too. So it's not just a written
original
thing. It's
interesting.
Yeah. And he's also out with a new album called Note by Note, which is, as far as I can tell, basically songs that he's done in the past redone with new singers and personnel. So there's all these things kind of
happening.
It's
like all Otis Redding songs and things like that redone for a new age.
Yep.
Okay,
yeah.
Got it.
So anyway, just to kind of summarize a little bit about Booker T. Jones.
That's what the show's about. Get to it.
That's right. He spent 8 years at Stax and worked with the people that I just mentioned in Booker T and the MGs, but also, as you may or may not know, Booker T and the MGs were a biracial or multiracial group. They're Booker T and Al Jackson Jr.
Yeah, two African Americans, two white
guys. The drummer, yeah. And Duck Dunn and Steve Cropper were white. And that was very unusual in the early 60s.
Yeah, even though Donald Duck Dunn wasn't the original bass player, right?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. And you
I'm
know
sure that, we'll get into all of
yeah.
that.
Yeah. Right? So what he says at the beginning of the book is Jim Stewart created a sanctuary, a fortress in enemy territory in Memphis, Tennessee, where the rules of segregation remained a feeble shadow and where whites and blacks created music together on a daily basis. But as we will see, that
only
you know,
happened inside.
Yeah,
those
there
walls.
Was there was that that was the way it started, but that wasn't always the way it was, and it couldn't be in United States of America. With, you know, as it still is now, racially divided. So Booker was born in Memphis in 1944. And as you recall, it's the same city that another person that we covered, Robert Johnson,
went and kind of professionalized.
Right. And he was from the Mississippi Delta, but he used to go to Memphis to get his culture, his education, and his musical, you know, kind of more musical influences than he could get in the Delta. So Memphis was it was a segregated city, but the blacks...
It had a middle-class African-American community that was tolerated, I think is the right word, by the white society.
Yeah. There was, it's kind of a parallel. Some black people were prosperous, middle class, you know, and then there was Beale Street with all the music. The education was highly, highly regarded. And he had a mom and a dad who were civil.
I hope so.
A civil servant. Like his dad was a science teacher, high school teacher.
Right,
his mom was a clerical worker.
Mm-hmm.
He had a warm, loving, stable home. And not just that, but he showed quite early that he was a musical prodigy. By age 6, he started to hear rhythms everywhere and began, as he said, to absorb all sound. And he was always thinking about music and all of the instruments he'd ever heard. And throughout his childhood and his teenagehood, he had this amazing, supportive group of parents, teachers, church, and a community of musicians that supported him and knew he was a musical genius and helped him feel comfortable and have the freedom to explore the way he needed to and wanted to.
Oh, just like my life.
Yeah. That's not what I've heard about your life.
Okay.
But so, yeah, so it was, you know, his mother played the piano. Both parents sang in church. So he had that, you know, he was greatly influenced by his mother's piano playing.
Yeah. Yeah. And both of his parents, right, were amateur musicians.
Yeah. Right? I think his dad was mainly a singer. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he got a paper route by, you know, at a young age. And his father bought him a clarinet when he was 9 years old. And he had his first performance at the neighborhood barbershop. And by the time he was in middle school, he was allowed in the school band, even though he was 3 years too young. The teacher recognized that he was more than capable and able to play. And he decided to take up oboe because no one else wanted to. And quickly learned several different instruments.
My school, everybody fought over the oboe.
Oboe? No, you know, oboe was a very unusual thing. It was very hard to play, too. That's why nobody wanted to play it.
Oh, really? Everybody fought over the oboe.
Really? No. Nobody fought over the oboe.
Right.
You're saying
no,
everybody...
Nobody, nobody fought over
okay.
the oboe.
It's got a different reed than any other instrument like that. But the most important thing is the first time he saw a Hammond B3 organ, he felt a powerful... Irresistible urge to
right.
sit at that organ.
I know that urge.
And he took on an extra paper route so he could pay for the more expensive lessons that it would have taken to
dedication.
By
that's
the time
how you do it, kids.
That's right.
Get an extra paper route.
Two paper routes.
Right.
And he was a busy boy. By the time he was 12, he played at afternoon teas that the African American church ladies gave in their homes, and he was employed to accompany Mahalia Jackson singing "Oh Precious Lord," and he felt that it was almost a religious experience.
Yeah.
Yeah, a powerful presence, a commanding and soulful voice.
Right.
So this recording that we're going to play doesn't have the 12-year-old Booker T. Jones playing on it, but mm-hmm. just to give you an idea of this woman who exerted such...
And what she could do, Mahalia Jackson,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, I mean, mm-hmm. what boy gets to do that?
Right. All right, so let's start off with a little Take My Hand, Precious Lord.
Precious Lord, take my hand, lead me on, let me stand. I am tired.
Well, first, Shelley.
Yes, ma'am.
Are you ready to pray with me?
Yes.
Praise Jesus.
I feel the Lord.
I felt it.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure Booker T did as well. And, of course, you know, there's that organ sitting underneath that whole thing, really causing your body to feel the words,
goosebumps.
You know. So,
yeah.
So I can see where that definitely made a big impression on the young man.
Oh yeah, yeah. In high school, by the time he was in 10th grade, he was the assistant band director. He was constantly too young for everything he was doing.
Yeah.
And he got together with Maurice White and Richard Chan, and Maurice White, who went on
Maurice
to be
White from Earth, Wind, and Fire?
That's right.
Holy shit.
Yep. They went to high school together.
Oh.
And they formed a band and, you know, went out and did gigs. This is how, you know, like many people like Tom Petty, Bruce Springsteen.
I bet they played a lot during September.
I think so. Yes. But unlike some of the other people that we've covered, he didn't have to like sneak out of the house or do this, you know, despite his parents.
No, they encouraged him.
Right.
They drove him to the places.
They did. They drove him.
And then waited outside for him to finish and then took him home.
And
then fed him properly.
That's
and
right.
And praised him for all the good hard work
that
he did.
Can you imagine? That's so wonderful.
No, I can't imagine.
And even when he started playing on Beale Street, like he took his bass to Beale Street when he was like a senior in high school and stood around and waited for people to ask him to sub for somebody or whatever. His dad got a former student of his who was also a musician to kind of chaperone Booker. So he always was under, you know, the watchful care of people in the community and his, you know, his family and, like I said, in the church. And it was there when he was playing on Beale Street that he bumped into Al Jackson Jr., and who was also very young for being a drummer in a band in, you know, in Memphis. And, you know, so that's where they first encountered each other. He, you know, still had his paper routes, but it turned out he had to kind of drop things because he was in the school band, he was in the marching band, he was doing church activities, he was in sports, he was actually dating, you know, it wasn't like he was a total nerd and didn't have a social life. And he played an additional instrument when he was in the marching band, which was trombone. So he was truly, from a very young age, a total multi-instrumentalist.
Wait, why is trombone that's in every marching band?
No, I know. I'm just saying he picked that up, too.
Oh,
you know?
Oh, he's already played the oboe.
Piano, clarinet, oboe,
and
Hammond
course,
B3,
Hammond,
bass,
right?
Guitar, and now trombone.
Well, of course.
So
okay.
Amazing, right?
Uh-huh.
And added to his other activities, in 1960, he started his career as a session musician while still in high school with Satellite Recording Studios, which later became
Stax.
Yes, and yes, it was, they had set up shop, as you've talked about in, you know, in the Rock and Roll Archaeology episode and in an old movie theater.
Mm-hmm.
They had the recording studio in the theater part and the record shop in the front. And this was Jim Stewart and his sister Estelle Axton's baby.
Right.
Yeah. So the first song he recorded with Satellite Records while in high school playing, now another instrument, saxophone, was Carla and Rufus Thomas, a daughter and father team. And the song was called 'Cause I Love You. And this is Booker T playing saxophone.
All right, let's listen to 'Cause I Love You. That was Stax's first hit when it was still called Satellite Records, which also did have a record store actually in the building.
Yeah.
That people could come and buy the records hot off the presses, as they might say.
Yeah. That, like a donut shop.
Yeah. Yeah. They baked them in the back every morning, bring them out front and, you know, have them ready for the early risers and the cops.
Yeah. Early risers.
Yeah.
Like donuts do. Very early. So that was his first session
1960,
job.
By the way.
1960.
Yeah.
When he was a senior in high school, of course, it came time for him to decide, you know, where to go to college, because that was part of
the
family's plan.
Yeah. Damn it.
Yep.
You're going to college.
And he applied to the Indiana University Music School in Bloomington. And he took some extra music theory classes after school, you know, in high school to be able to pass the exams he needed to get into that college. But he was still playing in the Satellite House Band. Well, not still. He started playing in the Satellite House Band almost every night after school. And the next song he played on, which I thought was very interesting how they recorded this. It's a song by William Bell, who went on to become one of their...
It ran Stax later.
Oh, no, that was Al Bell.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. William Bell was one of the staff songwriters.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I know.
Yes.
Everybody's name is Bell.
I'm mixing my bells up. Always mixing my bells up.
So the song was "You Don't Miss Your Water" (parentheses) till your well runs dry (close parentheses).
That's some of these. That's songs. A weird name. Yeah. That's a weird title.
And he played organ.
You don't miss
on
your water
till your well runs dry. He played organ on the song, but Satellite Records couldn't afford Hammond B3 yet, so he played the Hammond M3. And it was pumped to a speaker in the men's room, the men's restroom, where there was an echo in the tiled room, which was sent back to the sound room, mixed with the recording, and gave it this really unique and interesting sound. And so we're going to start the song from the second verse, because that's where we're going to
we'll hear that organ come in. Right.
Right. And, mm-hmm. you know, like the call and response between the singer and the organ. And they recorded it on the first take, and it was a hit.
Okay, folks, so listen closely. Listen to Booker T. Jones playing the M3 in the bathroom. Well, he's not playing in the bathroom, just the speakers in the bathroom. But it's subtle, but it's in there.
Yeah, but you can picture a men's restroom in a movie theater while you listen to the song.
I don't know if that would really be helpful, but sure.
Scratch and sniff, too.
You don't... Here's "You Don't Miss Your Water."
I kept you crying, sad and blue. I was a playboy. I wouldn't be true. But when you left, I miss my water, my well ran dry.
Ah, that's an awesome song.
Yeah.
Written and recorded by William Bell there, 1961. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I don't miss my water very often. Do you?
No, because...
I still can't get over that. I'm sorry. It's just, the title... Okay, interesting metaphor.
We have excellent water in San Francisco. We just turn the tap on.
Well, yeah, from Hetch Hetchy, you know. Yeah. So, it's from
I don't need to miss any water.
No,
I'm very lucky. I don't live in Flint, Michigan.
Well, or, God knows where else.
Or anywhere else in the world.
Yeah. But, that's definitely... a little insight into Booker T's, now famous instrument that he is mostly known for, which is the Hammond. Not quite the B3, but it's, the general gist is there, right?
Yeah, it's very cool. I love the sound that it's made, that's being made there with that very not modern technology.
Yeah, well, that's how they had to do things back in the day.
That's
you make it up, duct tape,
Yep. That's right. Shortly after that, everybody wants to know, how did Booker T and the MGs get formed, right? So are you going to ask me that question?
Hey, Shelley, how did Booker T and the MGs get formed?
Well,
I'm just wondering.
I'm glad you asked. In 1962... like I said, he was in the house band at Satellite Records.
Yeah.
The singer, Billy Lee Riley, who I don't know if anybody remembers at all, but he was supposed to record, and he had four studio musicians lined up to help him record an album, but he left, and he went to another studio for some reason. So these guys had a whole afternoon of studio time just to muck around. And they were Al Jackson Jr., Steve Cropper, Booker T. Jones, and Louis Steinberg.
I know we're going now.
Now, Louis Steinberg was the first
the original bass player. Right.
Player. Mm-hmm. And they started working up some ideas and just fooling around. And Steve asked Booker, there was a little tune you'd been fooling around with on the piano. Let's try working that up. So,
like every other band will after this thing comes out.
Right.
Yeah.
And every other band.
Just about.
So
well,
Booker,
every other band has a keyboard player, I should say. Somewhere along the line, somebody's going to start playing this thing, and then everybody's going to kick in and do the exact, you know, play the whole thing.
Yeah, it has to have a keyboard on it.
Yeah, you got
to
have a keyboard, though.
So he used
You're not doing this in a metal band.
Contrapuntal chord triad structural rules from the 18th century Baroque Bach.
Of course he did.
Yes.
Is there any other possibility?
He was a music student.
Yes, no surprise.
And he added a blues progression and a little swing, and that's how this song came together. They played it, and the Memphis sound was born. Louis said, "That's so funky, it smells like onions." And they wanted to call it Funky Onions. But Mrs. Axton,
who was
Jim Stewart's sister,
said,
"You can't call something Funky Onions in this day and time." And she decided green onions was better. So
It was
originally recorded as a B-side, released in May of 62.
That's right. It was a B-side.
Not released as an A-side until a few months later.
Well, it's an instrumental, so you can see why they probably went with that.
Yep.
But it became a staple and very quickly, and then they put it back out as an A-side, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it was immediately popular. Peaked at number 3 on the Billboard Hot 100 chart. And because they were going to put this out, they needed a name for their band, because you can't put a record out without a band name on it. So Al Jackson said, because Booker wrote the song, they had to call it Booker T and something. And he looked outside and he saw Chips Moman's MG automobile and blurted it out. It's got to be Booker T and the MGs. And they went off with that. And that name stuck.
Booker T and the Mighty Greats.
Yep. He was very young and inexperienced, but, you know, they put that record out and they had a new band.
Okay. Let's let everybody who may be going, there's got to be at least one person out there going, Green Onions?
I don't know that song.
What the heck is that?
They'll know it when they hear it.
Oh, of course. Here you go. Okay, first of all, you got to call out Cropper for that just awesome little guitar hits.
Yeah.
You know, every four beats.
Yeah.
You know, I always find it really interesting when you get a cat like Booker T, who's, you know, a musical genius, was a prodigy, and can play just about anything, but is able to dial it back to simplicity and create just a solid hook.
Yeah.
I know your brain's got to be going, well, I could put this diminished tin here and then there's the ninth over, you know, but refraining from doing that to keep it solid and simple.
I think the best musicians are like that. I mean, when you think of like George Harrison's guitar playing, he's not shredding. And Steve Cropper, for that matter, too. He's an incredible rhythm guitar player. He can play some solos, you know, but that's not what it's about. It's about being a band and
it's all about the song.
Yep.
You got to service the song.
Yep.
Yeah. And, you know, there are certain songs where, you know, shredding is, you know, what's required. But, you know, I've said this time and time again. I'll always keep saying this, that the muse lies between the notes. You know, and, you know, and jazz musicians are famously, you know, it's about, you know, the space in between is the point. And you know, you kind of definitely feel it. Everything's in its right place with that song.
Yeah. It's amazing how young the people in the band were too.
Yeah. Yeah. 1962. So he's like, what, 17?
Yep.
Yeah.
And that's the same same summer, 1962, before he went away to Bloomington to go to school, that he met somebody very important in his life, and he was very important in this man's life, and that was Otis Redding, who we talked about.
The big man.
That's right, the big man. Right. And we've talked about him, about one of his biographies. Yeah. We know a little bit about Otis, and you talked about him in the
Rock and Roll Archaeology, plays a big part.
That's right.
Our Stax, when we talked about Stax. Yeah.
You know, the thing I don't realize when we're talking about all this music history is just like Booker was only 17 when they met, and Otis was only 20.
Yeah.
And they came from totally different, you know, environments and upbringings. Mm-hmm. Otis was a purely instinctive, you know, singer, and he was all about
feeling.
It was
all emotion and, feeling, right. Whereas, you know, Booker was a trained musician, a student,
you know, and they just totally clicked from the moment Otis sat down on the piano bench, the story of Otis coming as a driver to drive his friend, I think Pine Top Perkins or somebody.
That's who it was.
Mm-hmm. Everybody thinking Otis was just the driver and the, you know, the roadie. And he had come specifically, though, because he wanted to sing for these people. And he plopped himself down next to Booker and started singing These Arms of Mine. And that was, and Booker was overcome, just like he had been when he sat down and played for Mahalia Jackson. That's how you know, I don't know. How deeply mm-hmm. Otis touched him.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So let's put the king on here and play a little of These Arms of Mine.
These arms of mine, they are lonely, lonely and feeling blue. These arms of mine, yearning from wanting you, and if you would let them.
Yeah, that is really an intense song, and you just like, okay, Otis, whatever you say. That's the way I feel.
From the female perspective, I'm sure that is a very common reaction.
That's right. He was quite a lady charmer.
Yeah.
They, you know, Booker says that this, you know, from this time on started a friendship between them, and their collaboration changed Booker's life and his attitudes towards music that he was composing. And Otis became a staple, of course, at Stax, and one of basically their most important artist after he got there. And so just as Booker started college in Indiana, Green Onions.
Let me just pause you for a minute. Okay. To give more accolades to Otis Redding. I think this is the last we're going to actually hear from Otis. Is that right? In the story with Booker.
Oh, he pops up again.
All right.
Yeah.
Of course, you know, he dies 1967, just after the Monterey Pop Festival, where, you know, it's his breakout performance. He's about ready to just become, you know, one of the biggest stars in the universe. Dies in a plane crash. And just as a new song is about ready to hit, which is Sitting on the Dock in the Bay, written just a couple of miles north of where we're at right now, up in
Sausalito.
Mm-hmm. And becomes the first posthumous number one record on the Billboard Hot 100.
Wow. Yeah. And not just that one, but right before he died in that plane crash, he was composing and recording furiously, as Booker says, as though he had a premonition about his death.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it was a huge loss.
Yeah.
To
And I think Stax itself was, you know, was concerned they could even survive.
Right.
That's
how important he was to that studio.
That was the point I wanted to make. So.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. But let's get back to the man in question, Booker T. Jones.
Yeah, Booker went off to college just as Green Onions was becoming a total hit. And the people in the music business couldn't believe that he was leaving, you know, Stax, even though he didn't really leave it, to not you know, take this opportunity to really dig into the MGs and tour and stuff like that because they had a hit. But he was determined to go to college. That's what his parents wanted. That's what he wanted. He wanted to be able to teach music, and he wanted to get a BA in music education. But what he did was he split his time between Bloomington, Indiana, and Memphis. And during the week, he went to school, took classes, played in the marching band. You know,
like a normal college kid.
And right? Was in a, you know, another, like a rock band also. And on the weekends, he took the bus or drove back to Memphis to play and record at Stax. So he was a busy, busy boy. And while, you know, one thing he said was that Indiana was a breath of fresh air because it was so much more liberal than Memphis, Tennessee, even though, like we said, Memphis had a strong middle class of black population.
Yeah.
But Indiana, I mean, it's sort of funny to think of now, like Indiana was liberal, you know, well, at least yeah. Bloomington was because yeah. it was a college town.
Yeah. And, you know, now we're in the 1960s and, you know, there is, you know, definitely the civil rights movement is in full swing.
Coming.
You know, granted, Indiana is not part of the Jim Crow South, although there's plenty of racism to be had.
Of course.
Everywhere, but yeah. Definitely an improvement. But I can see that he would enjoy being in Indiana compared to
yeah. And school know, the life that on was campus in. Was still segregated. I mean, people were very kind and friendly and all that, but the black kids who were in the minority definitely hung out together. Mm, you know, because
yeah.
that was. I mean, that was the way it was in my high school in LA too. You know, so. Things don't change that much. But around this time, also, Isaac Hayes joined Stax. And Isaac Hayes, who went on to have a very big solo career.
What you talking about?
Yeah. and film career, right? Mm. And he became one of the staff songwriters. And also, they became a keyboard tag team.
Oh, between Booker T and
right,
Isaac Hayes.
Because
yeah. Oh, yeah.
On all, mm-hmm. most of these songs, there was piano and organ. So mm-hmm. if, you know, they would just come in to record a song and one of them would take one chair and the other would take the other. And that's how it, you know, that's how it worked out. And around this time also, Louis Steinberg made some drunken mistakes, which got him thrown into the pen right before they were going to do a gig.
Uh-oh, need a new bass player.
In Knoxville. He drove his car up the steps of the Knoxville Coliseum, and they had to play the gig with just three people, no bass player. And while he was in jail, Steve Cropper got disgusted and had his eye already on Duck Dunn, who was playing with the Marquees. And so they just slid Duck Dunn in there, and poor Louis was out of a...
Out of a gig.
Out of a gig. Out yep. of a job.
Yeah.
He also realized at a certain point, Booker, that, you know, he like I said, he was very young and he was not well-versed in the business of music, as many musicians, and especially black musicians, as we know, were taken advantage of by white producers and label owners. And the same was true with Jim Stewart, who came in and, you know, I mean, he was a good guy, fostered this great musical atmosphere, but he also came in order to get production credits for, you know, like publishing rights for the songs that he recorded, even though they were written for the most part by Booker T or other people on staff. So they never had their publishing rights, which was something, of course, that went on throughout, you know, the music business, as we well know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So now we're going to get to a song that's kind of interesting because it had many different incarnations. And he originally heard this song in 1963 when Booker T and the MGs opened for Jackie Wilson in Chicago. And Jackie Wilson was a dynamic, electric singer. The women went total nuts for him.
Yep.
And Booker thought he was fantastic. About 4 years later, Jackie Wilson had a big hit with the song Higher and Higher. And this has a really interesting history for Booker because fast forward, Booker had a, you know, decided he'd like to hear it and play it differently. So he did a demo of Higher and Higher his own way, which he had Rita Coolidge and her sister Priscilla, who became Booker's wife,
right,
they sang backup with him. And then later,
Rita did it.
Even
well.
Later, he produced Rita doing his arrangement of Higher and Higher, and it was a huge hit.
I think that's
hit
the biggest hit.
Her.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that was the biggest version, if I remember right.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely. Should we play a little of each?
Yeah, a little bit, just
okay,
to give
so,
a flavor.
So we'll start.
Though we don't, I'm sorry, we don't have the demo of Booker singing it, but later in his life,
he recorded
a similar one himself.
Yeah, which has a lot in common with the Rita Coolidge
right,
version,
exactly.
If I remember
it's
right.
It's the same arrangement.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, so, but well, let's start with Jackie Wilson, which was the original out there, and then we'll go to Rita. Let's do the big one, Rita's, and then Booker T's most recent version of that.
Okay.
Of Higher and Higher.
Yeah.
Your love has lifted me higher and higher. Oh, man, that Jackie Wilson version, woo, that's hot. Oh, that's fucking hot.
I love the backup vocals on
that. Oh, yeah, yeah. That you want to talk about high. And, of course, you know, he's already got a 4-octave range. And now you got these, you know, girls in
like
the background going,
just,
oh, my God. Yeah, I was listening to that going, that's really up there.
Yeah.
Of course, you know, we do get to see that, I think that was number six, Hot 100. I think it was number one on the R&B charts. And then the Rita version got to number two. The Rita one is, they were both hits. Yeah.
Yeah.
At two different eras.
Right.
So thank you very much for getting me out of that mess.
All right. So, did we listen to Rita's too?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, and Booker's.
Okay.
Keep up.
All right. All righty. So, even though we're going back to 1963 here, because we just hopscotched
back
into the future.
Back to 63.
He's 19, yes. And he gets married.
Are we doing this in a DeLorean or?
No, we're just doing this in our imaginations, dear.
Okay.
All right. So he got married to somebody named Gigi, and she became immediately pregnant with Booker T. III, their first son. And they lived in married students' housing, which was, of course, a different experience for most of the people at school. Meanwhile, Booker was, you know, on the road back and forth to Memphis, arguably not a good, probably a very attentive first-time dad, because he was very, very busy.
Yes. Yeah,
very busy.
Yeah, he's still driving back and forth from Indiana to Memphis, right?
Right.
And he's still got a full school load and workload.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, goody.
Yeah. So, yeah, during the same period around 1964, he recorded another record with Carla Thomas at Stax. And this one was interesting because he was trying to arrange it in a way that she liked, and he tried every rhythm and tempo he could think of. And finally, she got sick of the whole thing and decided she didn't want to do the song. But like a true, true saying, he was persistent. And finally, he realized it needed a Motown-style bass line to work, and played it for her, and she was really excited, and they did the song, and everybody loved it. And, you know, what his point is that all the elements had been there, the vocalist, the, you know, the song, but that he needed to arrange them all into a way that actually made it work. It's what makes him a great arranger. And we do need arrangers.
Yes, we do.
So the song was...
No surprise he also does that.
Yeah. B-A-B-Y, baby.
Well, yeah, I could figure that out. B-A-B-Y, it means baby.
B-A-B-Y, baby.
All right, let's listen to it. Got something?
All right.
Hello? Check. One, yep. Two. Are you there?
Mm-hmm.
What were you talking about? What song did we just play?
We played B-A-B-Y, Baby by Carla Thomas.
I just wanted to make you spell it out again.
B-A-B-Y. Okay.
Let's get back to the story.
Yeah, let's get back to the story. No more listening to me sing. All right. So... meanwhile,
yes,
Otis was getting more into rock and roll.
Yes.
That rock and roll business.
Well, he was surrounded by them there at the Monterey Pop Festival.
That's right.
And you know, he could see the excitement. He could see what was coming. He could see that this was a coming out party, of which the Monterey Pop Festival really is.
That's right. And Booker tells about going to Monterey Pop's Festival right after the MGs got back from a European tour, and they were still wearing their teal mohair suits and really, you know, didn't quite, fit in Monterey, California, which there was all hippies and everything. And one of the songs they played at Monterey Pop was Satisfaction. Now, I thought it was... you know, by the Rolling Stones, as we all know.
Well, it is by the Rolling Stones.
That's right.
Yeah.
Now,
famously thought up by Keith Richards in the middle of the night by turning on a tape recorder and forgetting about it and finding it the next morning. Mm-hmm. He does admit that the line itself was created originally as a horn line, but later famously just kept with the distorted guitar and ushered in a whole new sound in 1965.
That's right. Well, that's very interesting, because what Booker says in his book is that Satisfaction was meant to be a guitar song. Now, maybe what he meant is it actually succeeded better as a guitar song. He thought that the opening on the Stones song was perfect.
Mm.
And actually, Booker, another instrument he played was guitar, but he was discouraged from playing guitar by Stax because they weren't oriented really towards guitar. But he loved playing guitar. But he realized that Satisfaction needed that electric guitar, and that it gave it some authority, and that lick, you know, that's so famous, made history. But Otis wanted to do it anyway. So they put in horns. They made a really tight arrangement. But Booker says, While the Stones record bounced and danced along, ours stomped and smashed you in the face. Who covers the Rolling Stones anyway? Well, all the bar bands do.
Well, now, including myself. It is kind of interesting that, you know, look, the Stones famously start off as, an English band trying to imitate African-American blues. These guys were aficionados, Richards, Jagger, Jones, and it's kind of full circle here that Otis and I believe the barkays or the horn section that are playing on that particular version from the Whiskey A Go-Go, along with Booker T and the MGs as the backing band, they are now taking a white band that's trying to play black blues, and now, so it's cool. It's awesome that that everybody is picking off of everybody at this point.
Yeah, that's what makes music interesting,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah. That's how it goes forward. You steal,
right, and mix and meld.
Get no satisfaction. I can't get no satisfaction.
The next song I wanted to talk about is by a pair that I just love, and they are Sam and Dave.
Oh, yes.
Now, Sam and Dave were an important Stax group, too, and they were, they did incredible duets. They danced. They were phenomenal.
Entertainers.
And a song that they did around that time that Booker played and arranged is called When Something Is Wrong With My Baby. It's actually written by Isaac Hayes and the other staff songwriter, who I can't recall who it was. When Booker heard them composing it in the next room, he was just drawn to it. It's like, I have to play on that record too. I mean, that's going to be an incredible record. And one of the things that drew him to it was that it was depicting life and love in its most beautiful state. And that's something he felt like he didn't have in his life yet. Like, he and his wife didn't have a great relationship. He didn't feel like, really in love. And he was searching for that for a long time. And on this song, Isaac is playing the piano and Booker is playing the organ. And he gives a beautiful explanation of how they laid the song out, how there's this a gospel piano, the answering B3, and it's played in 6/8 time. And I would like to play it from the second verse, which is Sam Moore, who had really the more, I think, beautiful voice and emotional rendering. And Booker says, "This is a record never to be forgotten."
All right, so let's play a little of Sam and Dave's When Something Is Wrong With My Baby.
People can say, she's no good. But oh, she's my woman, and I know I'm her man. And if she's got a problem,
that the combination of the organ just soaring like that, and the, like you said, the piano and Sam and Dave's voice is just chilling.
It's all there.
Yep, it's all that.
Yeah.
So he got his BA in music education, moved back to Memphis full time, and he felt like the music education was, you know, really worth having under his belt. He gained the ability to transcribe music to a score, proficiency and knowledge of brass, strings, and woodwinds, which helped him become a regular arranger at Stax, and a knowledge of music history that made him better at creating music. And while he was at Stax, he played every conceivable instrument, whatever was needed or asked for, from tambourine to tuba.
Yeah.
I like that tambourine. Speaking of T's, it's like we're on Sesame Street and T is the letter.
The letter?
The letter.
Is yeah. T.
The letter is T, tambourine to tuba.
Booker T.
Yeah. Booker T, time is tight.
Time is tight.
Okay. So, we another
better than peas.
Yeah.
Peas.
Popper blocker. Another very well-known, I think, song of Booker T and the MGs is Hip Hug Her.
I love that fuzz on the bass.
Yeah.
That's got hair on it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I like it too.
Amazing.
I'm very drawn to bass lines, and so that is it for me.
Then why don't you marry one?
I want to marry a bass line.
I want to marry a bass line when I grow up.
When I got to college, I learned how to play the bass just because I love bass lines so much.
Oh, there you go.
Yep.
Oh, how come you're not a bass player?
Well, I can play the bass.
Oh, okay.
You know, but now I'm learning how to play the piano.
I know. And you want to be a singer.
I'm kind of like Booker T, you know? Oh. I play the bass, the guitar, the piano, the flute, all very, very badly. But, you know, still, I'm spreading it around.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like a virus?
Yeah, right. I'm spreading it like peanut butter, actually.
We got to get moving, man. Yep. We're getting behind.
I know, we're being silly. Okay, another incredible performer and artist that Booker worked with was Albert King.
Oh, yes.
Now, before he worked with Albert King, he'd heard rumors about Albert being scary and violent, but he was actually totally sweet. And they worked up a song for Albert King called Born Under a Bad Sign.
Know it well.
Now, I did not know. I thought that was a traditional song, but that was written by William Bell with music by Booker. And because astrology was kind of big at the time, that's why
the name
Bell, you know, wrote it like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Albert King provides, of course, his amazing guitar fills. Booker said he was like a contortionist when he played the guitar. And of course, he was left-handed, and that I believe he played the guitar upside down, but I'm not really sure.
He played a flying V, so it doesn't matter.
Oh, okay.
He just flipped it around.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure the nut had to be changed, but the knobs were probably... No, I don't know. Maybe. But he mostly played a flying V, I remember.
Yeah, I don't know that. I mean, now I do. I know that now. A flying V.
Well, see, I've helped out. I've done my duty today.
That's right.
All right, 1967.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I thought it was 64, but... If you say it's 67, you must know. Yeah, it probably is.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it was recorded in 66.
Okay.
But it came out in 67.
All right.
Yeah.
Let's have a listen.
Born under a bad sign.
I've been down since I began to crawl.
I'm around, no luck at all.
You know, the interesting thing about this is we tried to play this song in my band, and it seems like it's simple, but when it kept confusing us, and now I know why, because it doesn't follow the typical 12-bar blues 1-4-5 progression.
Right.
So, you know, it's like you keep thinking, oh, are we changing now? No, we're not changing. Wait, now we're changing. It just kind of catches you a little off guard. It makes it interesting.
Yeah. It kind of also gives me a little, early Southern rock sound to it. I mean, it's got, you know, it's definitely blues, but there's it's 67, so we're a couple of years before Southern rock, you know, begins to take off, 69, 70, sort of period with the Allman Brothers.
This was a precursor.
Yeah, it sounds like a little bit of a precursor. Just listening to it again, you know, this is a song I've heard a million times.
Right.
But thinking about it and going, wow, that's just such a fucking badass song. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. But you already touched on Otis's death that happened in 1967, and of course devastated everyone. And Booker had to play at the funeral and just was in another world because he was grieving himself, and he had to concentrate to play. He had to actually open the music, you know, to read the music to play the organ part that he knew very well because he was so grief-stricken.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 1968... Stax was in Memphis in this area of town where this movie theater, and there weren't that many places in Memphis for black and white people to meet. And since Stax was a movie theater, it didn't have a meeting room. So they would meet at this hotel called the Lorraine Motel, which accepted both blacks and whites. And they would have their meetings there where they would have meals there. They would swim in the pool and then they would go back and finish their recording. And that happened to be where Martin Luther King was assassinated in April of 1968.
Yeah, yeah, and the same hotel.
Yeah, right. And they were highly disturbed. I mean, he was highly disturbed for many reasons, but it felt personal because it felt like this happened in our backyard. This was our turf. You know, like, how dare somebody kill King on my back porch?
Yeah, like two blocks away from the Stax studios there. So,
but that sparked something in Booker to like really
question the situation and
racial
harmony
mm-hmm.
in Memphis, which, you know, was not harmonious at all.
Right.
Maybe truce would be a better word to put there. And of course, now
it was an agreement. Yeah. We're going to live side by side. But not
just fucking
really equal,
shit.
As Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas. Separate but equal is not equal.
No, bullshit. Don't get me started.
Yeah.
I can imagine that things, and I do know for a fact that things begin to change for the African American musicians at that moment, feeling that, this quote unquote truce wasn't really working out for him.
Right. And specifically at Stax, the realization that Booker had was, oh, I thought that we were all friends and equals here, but it's only within the walls of this studio and maybe the Lorraine Hotel. But otherwise, the white people I work with are not my friends. They're not going beyond work and, you know, beyond daily interactions. And what he said was the relationship failed to evolve into a sense of caring beyond the boundaries of our workspace.
Yeah.
And one really good example of this, and not to say, you know, Steve Cropper is, you know, a racist, but this was the place and time he was born in, that he made a comment in a magazine after King was killed and basically said, hey, Memphis was a racially cool place until Martin Luther King showed up. And Booker was just shocked that he would say something like that. But it just shows kind of the tone deafness of white people about the true experience of black people. You know, it's like everything's going along fine for me. I don't know why somebody's complaining, but it's like you don't know what it's like for the black people in Memphis because you're white. How would you know? Booker had to, you know, really realize and swallow. And it led to him kind of questioning being at Stax and playing with Booker T and the MGs.
Yeah. there was a lot of soul searching after King's death, and you know the riotings that occurred. You know, as we say in rock and roll archaeology, 1968 was a bloody year. Anyway, you looked at it in Vietnam, across Europe, and certainly in America.
Yeah. But he had a little bit of reprieve for a certain amount of time after this period where he was invited to a Hollywood producer, director named Jules Dessin. I don't know if he was actually French, but that's how you would pronounce it if it was French, mm-hmm. to score the music for a major Hollywood feature film called Uptight, which was a movie some people consider now the first blaxploitation film. But it was a movie about a struggle of two revolutionary black brothers in Cleveland. And he had to actually go to Paris for the post-production and realize while he was in Paris that, you know, Paris was really wonderful to be in because it didn't have that racial baggage that the U.S. and especially the South had. And he was able to really be, you know, feel more comfortable and feel freer moving about and you know, enjoying the delights of Paris.
Yeah. And, you know, many African-American artists have experienced that of, you know, going to Europe and finding that they are treated with far more respect mm-hmm. than they are yeah. At home in America.
Right. One of the songs he wrote at this time while for that movie was called Johnny, I Love You. And this was the first song that he was allowed to sing on. At Stax, he wasn't permitted to sing. The MGs all said, no, none of us is a good enough vocalist, you know, to record. But Booker actually has a beautiful voice. And he was very pleased to be able to, you know, be the actual singer on this very personal song that he wrote called Johnny, I Love You.
Let's do it. Johnny, I Love You.
Johnny, Johnny, I love you. I said, Johnny, buddy, I love you. The world is cold, man, but you're my friend. It's you and me, Johnny, right to the end. I said, Johnny, Johnny, I love you. I said, Johnny, baby, I love you.
Hey, it's the first time we get to hear Booker T. Jones sing.
Oh, yeah. I love his voice. Yeah, it's just warm cool. And, you know, beautiful.
It's not Otis. It's not Sam and Dave. But
it's him.
Yeah. It fits his musical personality. It's pure.
It's warm.
It's not like Isaac Hayes, you know, who has that attitude in just about everything he does. But it just fits perfectly and nicely. It sits sweetly in the music.
Yeah. Yeah. And the song that we played at the beginning of this episode, Time is Tight, was also written in France. And was part of the soundtrack of the movie Uptight. So we will visit that again at the very end.
Stay tuned, folks.
Okay. So he meets Priscilla Coolidge, Rita Coolidge's sister, around this time. And he, you know, just falls for her. He eventually gets a divorce from his wife, Gigi. And this, you know, relationship with Priscilla is kind of fraught from the get-go. People cautioned him not to get together with her and certainly not to marry her. And it turned out, you know, she really may have been kind of using him because she wanted to further her own musical career. And in fact, you know, even though he produced three of her albums and she had a great voice, I mean, arguably technically better than Rita's, she kind of blamed him for never making her a star, where she thought that he had made Rita a star with Higher and Higher.
Isn't that up to her?
Yeah.
So, Okay.
So, yeah, we've talked about that before.
Yeah.
You know, what's stardom? It's not all technical ability, that's for sure.
No. In fact, no, you can put out the, you know, the coolest, hottest, you know, record out there. And if it just doesn't arrive at the right moment, it's, you know,
right.
There's nothing you can do
so
about
many
it.
Things
it's
in
so
play.
Fickle. It's, you know, a lot of people like to assume, oh, you know, today we can do it with algorithms and we have the data points to be able to put a song together and guarantee it in the top 10. And that's bullshit. But yeah, when the music quality is reduced to, you know, a lack of serious competition, you might be able to get away with that, but not in those days. Where, you know, everybody's just trying to one-up each other. Thank you, John, Paul, George, and Ringo for starting that off. But, you know, that was still going strong, you know, 10, 15, even 20 years beyond that.
Yeah, their relationship didn't go well. I know he was in it for much longer than he thought was healthy for him.
Like a good man, he probably tried his best and
yeah.
tried everything he could and just didn't work out. Didn't she get murdered or something like that?
Yeah, she was involved in a murder-suicide. First, she left him for Ed Bradley, the newscaster, and then they divorced.
60 Minutes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And then they divorced, and then she married somebody else who ended up killing her and himself.
Oh.
Yeah, she had a tragic end. Mm. It's very sad. Meanwhile, the hippie movement was affecting...
In full swing?
Yeah, and affecting Booker because he's, and also, you know, King's death and kind of seeing what was going on at Stax and not being included, you know, and not being given publishing rights and his fair share of the money that was being made at Stax. He wrote a song called Old Man Trouble. And I know there's other songs named Old Man Trouble, but this was his song. And he stayed up at the studio very late, brought some musicians in, and made this great recording along with horns. And he took it to Al Bell at home because he was so excited about it. Al Bell, who was also a black man.
Now running Stax.
Running Stax and a businessman. So he was more conservative because his job and his money depended on being kind of conservative. And the song was basically about, you know, kind of the black man as a slave in current society. And Bell rejected it and said, we can't put this out. And that's when Booker knew that he had no place at Stax anymore, that he needed to keep going ahead with his career and not still being, quote, a slave on the plantation. So unfortunately, when he had this realization, he went back and erased the tape of the song. But I found a later version of it on YouTube. I thought we could play a little bit of it because it is very affecting and shows the state of mind that he was in at the time.
Okay, so let's listen to a little of a redone version of Old Man Trouble by Booker T. Jones.
Quite a departure from what he had been composing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we get to hear his voice again, mm-hmm. which, as I said, is beautiful.
Yeah.
And shortly after he erased the tape, he left for L.A. He left all his possessions in Memphis and went to L.A. in 1969, where Billy Preston had previously kind of lured him there by saying, "What, you're not making any money out there in Memphis. I'm making like, you know, $50,000
yeah,
a year
of money
or whatever."
In LA,
yeah.
Right, yeah.
And he was like, he had to join AFTRA and, you know, is that's the music union, right?
And
anyway, he joined the music union
yeah.
and started making some money. Yeah, he met true. Leon Russell. He got involved, you know, in the Laurel Canyon scene. He got a house with Priscilla and Rita, who had been living with Leon Russell, moved in with them with her 9 cats. And they had all kinds of characters like Joe Cocker and Stephen Stills and Graham Nash and, you know, hanging out at their house. So it got kind of incorporated into the hippie movement. He spent some time in Malibu. He started doing a lot of session work with people like Richie Havens. Actually, I think he produced Bill Withers' album, Ain't No Sunshine. He worked with Barbara Streisand, Stephen Stills, Rita, Willie Nelson, Bob Dylan, Jackie DeShannon, Kris Kristofferson, the band. You know, he was just like put in the middle of all that stuff.
Of course.
Yeah. Now, one day when Bob Dylan was visiting him on his ranch in Malibu, he took his guitar outside and played a song for Booker called Forever Young. And Booker felt like he was being blessed by a rock icon or somebody like in the presence of Woody Guthrie when Bob Dylan was serenading him. And he asked Booker what he thought of the song, and Booker said he should record it. But when he finally recorded it, it sounded nothing like the song he had played at Booker's house. So that was Bob Dylan. You know, he was constantly reforming and changing and rearranging his music. Now, in 1973, Bob knocked on Booker's door just after midnight and asked him to come to Burbank to play bass on a track. And Booker was like, what are you talking about? Can't we do this tomorrow? But he went anyway, and it turned out they were recording Knocking on Heaven's Door for the movie soundtrack.
Pat Garrett
and Billy the Kid.
Yep.
With Kris Kristofferson,
right.
Who was like, got so much money from that movie and was like, dumbfounded, like, what am I supposed to do with all this money? Oh, I know. I think I'll go buy some alcohol.
Knocking
on Heaven's Door, here's Booker T playing bass.
Take this badge off of me. I can't use it anymore. It's getting dark, too dark to see.
Yeah, you know, every once in a while, there's one of those songs that Bob sings that you go, Jesus Christ, he can sing good.
Yeah.
You know, and... you know, I just got to see him a couple months ago at the Frost Theater, and I think that was the third or fourth time I've seen him, and this time it was like, oh, the full Bob Dylan experience, where you were like, okay, I get it.
Mm-hmm. Did he sing good?
Yeah, he sang pretty good, and you know,
he goes back and forth and being able.
And, you know, and he played some songs that, you know, everybody knew, and you know, he kind of enjoyed the crowd, and the crowd enjoyed him, and you know, he can be quite the iconoclast on stage. And anyway, I didn't know Booker T played bass on that.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
He played on many things, I think, that we don't know about, and who knows what instrument it was. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
Unfortunately, around. In 1975, Al Jackson Jr. was shot in the back and killed, and the murder was never solved. Mm. It's something that still obviously rankles with Booker,
mm-hmm.
you know, that a black man's murder is not taken seriously, and he, you know... continues
I hope
to.
He considers that far more than just Al Jackson.
That was a personal example, you know, of like, are you going to follow this up? Are you going to solve the murder? Oh, I guess it's not that important.
No.
But so that was sad, because then when the MGs, you know, did get back together once in a while, they didn't have their drummer, you know, they had to actually at one point he bumped into Ringo in LA and said, you know, just decided to ask him if he would ever play on any of his recordings. And Ringo just said, call Jim Keltner. So Jim Keltner ended up to be somebody that filled in for Al Jackson Jr. From time to time.
Yeah, and Jim Keltner's quite the monster himself. Yeah.
Yeah, Jim Keltner's awesome.
Yeah.
Another awesome musician that Booker became quite friendly with. And
hold on a minute. Let me guess.
Yeah. And he talks about smoking weed with Willie Nelson, too, quite a bit. Like, at one point he was producing. So he produced his album Stardust, which was one of course, Willie's, best-selling albums, I think, where he does standards. So they got together in Malibu and just jammed. And then Willie asked him to come and record an album for him, which they recorded in Emmylou Harris's house, because her husband, Brian, had a mobile recording truck in the driveway.
Well, I guess if it's sitting there, somebody's got to use it.
Got to use it. Right. He makes a joke about, if that's something that would cause divorce in many a family. Get that fucking truck out of my driveway. They placed instruments in different rooms in the house, and the recording was done in 10 days. And the interesting thing about the song Stardust was that it was written by Hoagy Carmichael, who also went to college at the Indiana University School of Music, just like Booker did.
That's cool.
Yeah, and Booker thought that was really cool. And what he learned at music school, he used to write charts for Willie's version of the song, which is his favorite version of the song.
All right. Well, let's listen to Willie Nelson's version of a very well-covered song from 1927 by Hoagy Carmichael, Stardust.
Sometimes I wonder why I spend the lonely nights dreaming of a song, the melody haunts my reverie, and I am once again with you. When our love was new.
Oh, I love that plucking Willie there with his with Trigger, right? That's the name of his guitar. That's
Booker says he got so stoned on the set though that often he forgot where they were, and what? Booker, snap out of it.
Yeah. Well, quit giving me the weed. Yeah. I can get some work done.
And Booker wasn't a big drug taker either, that was funny. Yeah. Okay, his relationship with Priscilla tanks right after Priscilla adopts a baby girl, like the next day, without telling Booker. Like, I'm bringing a baby girl home that I signed up to adopt. And then a year later, Priscilla leaves him for Ed Bradley. So he's now a single father, and he meets his current wife, Nan, in 1983. It was love and attraction at first sight. She had her own children. He had his own children. They had a blended family, and then they had three children of their own. So they have quite a big multiracial blended family. In fact, one whole chapter he writes about his love and appreciation for his wife.
Oh,
it's so sweet.
Nice.
Yeah. It's very sweet.
I'm glad he's found permanent happiness.
Yeah. It's for real this time. Yeah. He learned from his mistakes, and he...
Don't we all?
Yeah.
Well, never mind.
We don't all.
I do. Yeah. But I know most don't.
I like to think I do.
I try.
Too.
I think about it.
Yeah.
I mean, when I make a mistake or an error or anything else,
Well, especially
I put some time and effort into it.
Like bad marriages, hopefully.
Well, I haven't had too many of those. So.
Yeah. Well, I haven't had any of those.
See?
I just had the one good one.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're lucky.
I'm smart.
Yeah.
So, the next amazing musician he hooks up with is Neil Young.
Oh, Mr. Young.
Like, kind of don't really
new
think
citizen
of him.
Young. You know, he just got his citizenship.
Oh, no, I didn't. Why would he want
to
do that? Oh, sorry.
He's been trying to get him for years.
Oh, okay.
Apparently, they were on hold because of a moral clause.
Oh.
Did you know that? Because he's smoking weed.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So,
but apparently that's not important.
Those of
anymore.
Us who are born in the United States get to smoke weed
freely.
And still be citizens.
That's right.
They haven't made a no weed smoking citizenship clause yet. It's only no pregnant women.
Ooh. Can.
Anyway,
yeah.
So I believe he used Jim Keltner on that album, but I'm not sure now that I think about it. But the Duck Dunn and Booker T. Jones produced Neil's album, Are You Passionate? And Booker has nothing but great things to say about Neil and his performances, that they were passionate. They always have magic in them. And Booker was moved by his music almost more than anyone else's.
Mm, yeah.
Peter Farioli will be happy to hear that.
I don't think anybody's ever had bad things to say about Neil. They have like, you know, things to say about Shaky, just, you know, more, you know, just Neil does his own thing, but nobody ever has anything bad things to say about Neil.
Yeah. What Booker says was, Neil Young, you don't have to like him. You just had to love him. So the song that I think shows, you know, Booker's influence on Neil, plus I can hear the organ in the background, is When I Hold You in My Arms.
All right, let's do it. When I Hold You in My Arms by Neil Young and Booker T. Jones.
It's a breath of fresh air. When I hold you in my arms, I forget what's out there. All those people with their faces walking up the street.
Well, that was cool with Neil.
Yeah. I like that.
All right. So I think we're getting close to the end here.
I mean, not the end of his musical career.
Oh, by no stretch of the imagination. In fact, I believe there was just going to have to be a volume 2.
Right. Maybe. You know? Yeah, so, maybe.
Because he's still busy as hell.
He is. He's very busy. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to note that in 94, the MGs came back together to record an instrumental album, and they won their very first Grammy, if you can believe that. It's kind of hard to believe. They should have gotten a Grammy for Green Onions, but was for a song called Cruisin' for Best Pop Instrumental Performance. And then in 07, they won a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Recording Academy. So that was a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
In 2012, he played at the White House. Now, what he remembers about that is that Obama wanted to enter the room to Green Onions instead of Hail to the Chief, which is very cool.
Of course.
We miss him.
Oh, yes, we do.
And in 2013, he came back again to the White House to a Memphis Soul performance, and Obama sang a few bars of Let's Stay Together, which hounded him till the end, because every time he went somewhere, people wanted him to sing something.
Right.
And nowadays, Booker is still active. He's on the road. In fact, his son Ted plays guitar with him. Dave and I, my husband and I, saw Booker in San Francisco, and they played, he has two different things he does. He has a kind of a smaller group that he plays with his son, Ted. And then he does some shows that are called the Stax Review, where they have a 10-piece ensemble and they play songs from all the people, Otis, Sam and Dave, Booker, you know, the MGs, Wilson Pickett and stuff like that. And that's the one we saw. That was really cool.
All the good stuff.
Yeah. Right, and he's become quite a family business now. His wife is a tour manager. His Ted plays guitar and manages the musicians. His daughter is their manager, and she's also a lyricist. And his other daughter is their social media director. So
wow, it really is all in the family, isn't
it's
it?
It's really, really neat that they can do that together. So I thought it would be nice to kind of have our last song be a song that he does with his son, which is called Father Son Blues.
All right, let's play a little of that, and then we'll come back with the recap and
the outro,
the review, and then work our way out of here. All right,
okay.
Father and Son Blues. we're back.
We are.
Yeah.
Yeah. I really like this book, and I really encourage people to listen to it on audio. You hear Booker's smooth and reassuring voice, and you hear all those musical phrases that he plays on the organ. And yeah, it's a really cool way to listen to it. One thing I was struck by while reading the book was that I've read now two books in short time that have Memphis as a kind of a backdrop. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it was just really interesting to remember the description of Robert Johnson's time in Memphis and then Booker T's time in Memphis. And I also love how he sometimes, more than some people might want, people that aren't musicians, but he describes in great detail, you know, chord progressions, how the songs came together, how the different musicians played on them, what made the songs work, you know, all as a part. And yeah, I found that very interesting because I'm interested.
So would you say that it gravitates mostly to musicians, or do you think it just doesn't matter?
No, I don't think it matters. I mean, you know, that's not a huge part of the book. You know, it's just like, if you're interested, you read it and maybe you go to the piano and go like, what did he mean by that? You know,
yeah.
Let me try to, or listen to the songs and try to, you know, follow along with his description. But the way that he writes and how he kind of connects memories back and forth and his nice storytelling style, I think anybody interested in that kind of music and any of the musicians I've mentioned in Stax in general would really enjoy this book.
All right. Well, go out and grab Booker T's new memoir. Also, I think you said he's got a new album that's...
Oh, yeah, it's called Note by Note.
Note by Note is out and about. And if he's touring near you, you're going to want to grab a ticket.
Yeah.
All right. All right. So you like the book.
I did.
And well,
and I like Booker, too.
Yeah. Yeah. He certainly comes across as a class act, doesn't he?
Yeah, he really does.
All right.
A gentleman.
Well, of course, you know, to end this, we got to go back to the beginning and play the more up-tempo portion of Time is Tight, huh?
Yeah, I think that's fitting because, you know, time is tight and time, you know, goes through the book and, you know, and the future is the present and the past is the future.
And it's time to go.
Yeah, and it's time. Time is tight.
All right,
I got to get out of here.
We will see you with the next episode of Rock and Roll Librarian. Do you know what the book's going to be?
I'm looking at a memoir that's coming. Oh, I know. It's going to be The Doors.
Oh,
it's going to be Jim Morrison.
No one here gets out alive.
Yeah. It's old.
Yeah.
I do new stuff, yeah, but this one's old.
All right. All right. Look forward to that. And let's get out with Time is Tight. Okay.
Rock and Roll Librarian, produced and hosted by Christian Swain. Co-host, Shelley Sorensen. All sound design and incidental music by Jerry Danielson. All quotes performed by actors unless noted. Find all of our shows, notes, social, and links at www.pantheonpodcast.com or wherever you listen to great podcasts. All songs can be found for purchase on iTunes, Spotify, or Google Play. Please purchase these great and important tracks. Find us on Facebook at The RNRAP. We are on Instagram at RNR Archaeology. Tweet us at R&R Archaeology.